This podcast is produced in association with Educare, part of the TES family. Educare's simple-to-use online learning service for expert knowledge in safeguarding and duty of care will help empower all your staff with the confidence to act when needed.
Hello and welcome to the TES podcast. I'm Simon Locke and today I'll be exploring the new look landscape of safeguarding and asking how the last 6 months of school closures and home learning have impacted the lives of students and how the technology we've adopted to cope with lockdown has changed the requirements for schools. I'm joined today by Katie Rigg and Chris Durbin from the Council of International Schools, who will be explaining some of the things that leaders need to be wary of when it comes to social media and students' increased exposure to screens. But first, I'll be speaking to Emily Constantis from the Safeguarding Alliance, who explains how she's been working with schools with regards to their provision of remote learning. Before I kick off, if you'd like to know more about how safeguarding has changed since the coronavirus outbreak, we've got two webinars coming up, the first of which features Regional Head of Schools at Orbital Education, Michael Clack. To find out more and register for the session, visit tes.com/school webinars or click on the link in the description. Hi, Emily. Thanks for joining us on the podcast today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I've given a brief bio there, but I don't imagine I've done your role justice. Would you like to tell us a little bit about what you do and what Safeguarding Alliance is sort of responsible for in the UK and internationally?
Yes, thank you so much. So obviously I'm a CEO of the Safeguarding Alliance. We are an international company supporting schools all over the world, really, implementing standards in safeguarding. We have schools which are member schools. We offer training and we also ensure best practice through a safeguarding audit. Something that we're leading the way here in the United Kingdom is with a campaign for a legal reform affecting safeguarding provision. So that's just another aspect of what we do.
Okay, brilliant. And we're talking today about technologies that have come on sort of leaps and bounds over the last 6 months. When schools went into lockdown and lots of things in society seemed to be slowing down, grinding to a halt, actually technology in the classroom was coming on, you know, rapidly, and schools were quickly adopting new technologies. And during that period, what sorts of things were schools coming to you with? What sort of concerns were you supporting them with?
Yes, I think one of the biggest concerns that we started to see very early on during the initial lockdown period was how to critically manage a whole school closure very, very quickly. And actually the long-term safeguarding provision that needed to be implemented. Because obviously when the school initially closed down, the first response was to get everybody home safely, ensure that everybody knows what they're doing with regards to contacts, information, and actually how we're going to deliver an academic provision remotely. Many schools that we worked with around the world hadn't previously used an IT facility to support an online learning platform. So it was a real shock, and many schools were actually finding themselves having to very, very quickly adapt, buying in provision and actually making it work. The other thing that we would say on the flip side of it is families were not prepared for an online learning provision, and this created a lot of stress for many families and actually created an inequality of provision, because essentially not every family had access during the lockdown period to an online facility or to a computer, which actually meant that In some cases, pupils were getting an absolute excellent online provision, but actually in other cases, they weren't. And it's how we then look and ensure from a safeguarding perspective that every child has the same opportunity.
Yeah. And are you finding that schools now are starting to consider technology more and more as part of their ongoing sort of curriculum planning, and is blended learning something that you're supporting schools with?
Yes, so I think that the majority of schools around the world now are probably going to continue to use some form of online learning as we go forward. And actually, I'm so fed up of the terminology, the new normal. But actually, it is about coronavirus is here. It could be here for a very long time, and it's not learning to just manage and go along with the process. It's actually how we learn to live alongside coronavirus and potentially have future lockdowns, be that a partial school lockdown or a whole school lockdown. I think the most important element now is the preparation and the planning side that goes into the safeguarding provision, and actually going forward, implementing a robust IT facility that can ensure children can maintain that learning provision is absolutely imperative. But again, it has to be a provision that is equal to all.
Okay, and if schools are looking to adopt a new piece of technology as part of this provision, where do they start? What sort of procedures should they go through? What sort of paperwork should be in place? And what should they be looking for in that piece of tech, I guess, to make sure it's up to standard?
So I think the first thing that schools will need to look at is actually this their online safety provision. It's whatever piece of technology the school decides to use, whether they buy in a provision, whether they decide to build their own provision. What we first need to do before we do anything is actually provide the parents, the carers and the pupils the skills to stay safe online. Essentially, I keep referring to Pandora's box, but we have opened up Pandora's box with regards to online safety. Some pupils are using the internet for the very first time for an online provision. And actually, if we're pushing young people to the internet, we need to ensure that they know how to stay safe. So actually, I think schools need to look at ensuring that staff are fully upskilled with regards to online safety, and pupils are continuously updated as to how to stay safe online. I think that's the first starting point. The second thing that I would say is actually contracts need to be reviewed, job descriptions need to be reviewed, inserting a COVID-19 clause to ensure that any changes to provision are actually represented in practice and actually within policies as well. With so much change taking place, it's absolutely imperative that policies are robust and represent how we are now going to keep our children safe in a remote learning platform. I know many schools at this time have been reviewing policies, and many schools have been adding a COVID-19 annex, but we need to go even further in depth with that. We need to ensure that actually that policy becomes a living document and we are actually applying that into practice when we're keeping children safe online.
So you mentioned there how it sort of goes beyond teachers to educating the pupils and parents as well. So if we can sort of break those sections down quickly, from a teacher's point of view, what changes when they're administering a lesson online rather than in the classroom? What sorts of things should they be aware of? What should they look out for?
Well, from a safeguarding perspective, it's how we then identify signs and symptoms of potential abuse and neglect in an online platform. Because in a day-to-day basis, when we're seeing the pupils face-to-face, we would pick up on little things that actually we can stop them escalating with a good early intervention strategy. It's about retraining staff how to safeguard appropriately and robust safeguarding through an online platform. When we discuss safeguarding, it's not just about safeguarding the pupil. We also need to ensure that staff know how to keep themselves safe online. And actually, we need to give staff, we need to equip them with the skills to keep themselves safe. So for example, ensuring that if they're delivering an online session, and it is through an online platform, that it's with a registered account. We are having a locked session. If possible, we can have pupils with a remote user process on their laptops themselves, so we can implement internet filtration systems. But again, this may not be possible dependent as to where you're based geographically, and also the means of the child themselves actually having internet in the home or a computer themselves. But I think with regards to staff, I think it's really important that robust training is provided so they understand what the changes are, how it affects them in practice, and how they can actually apply this to keep themselves and the pupils that they're teaching safe.
Yeah, so it's an interesting one with looking for sort of signs of potential abuse, things like that, from a distance, I guess. What would a teacher's sort of course of action be when raising concerns? Obviously, because if the child is at home, raising some sort of concern when they're at home in a sort of an environment might, where they may be sort of under threat, I guess the process would be very different as to if they were in the classroom with you, for example.
And I think this is exactly what we're saying in terms of reviewing practice. If we are reverting to teaching online, and we need to ensure that that referral process can take place, it's about evidencing. So if we're asking teachers to record any potential areas of concern, does that teacher have the equipment needed in order to record it appropriately, store the information appropriately, and actually cascade that information onto the designated safeguarding lead or child protection officer within their school? So it's about reviewing not just practice, but what actual technical facilities the schools are implementing. Many schools prior to COVID-19 that we are working with internationally and nationally did not solely operate in an electronic referral system. So many schools would complete a physical concerns form, which would be physically handed into the designated safeguarding lead. But during coronavirus and during lockdown, they had to suddenly revert to and actually adapt their changes to practice and use an online and electronic form. So it's about ensuring that if we are going from a physical form to an electronic form, have staff received training? Do they know how to access it? Do they know how to complete it? And do they know how to send this information on in a very secure manner? Because potentially we're talking about drafting child protection concerns, and they shouldn't just be openly stored on a computer. So it's, I think the core of this goes to really robust safeguarding training that must be adapted to meet the changes in practice during coronavirus.
And with the sort of logistics of an online lesson from a school's point of view, looking to implement perhaps a blended learning approach, what sorts of things have you found schools are doing? Are they recording lessons? Is there a data protection challenge there? And what about sort of like one-to-one meetings with perhaps more vulnerable children? What are you seeing a sort of trend in what schools are tending to adopt?
Yes, so what we've during coronavirus, actually, we've provided for free for many schools all over the world. We've actually put together a wealth of resources that schools are able to have access to that have robust user agreements, codes of conduct, which actually highlight all of these issues raised, including full policies that they can download as well. What we would say with this is it's really important to place safeguarding as a top priority. In a normal situation, a one-to-one session with a pupil, you would ensure that you wouldn't have a locked room. You would ensure that there's somebody else there to take notes. And there's no different to an online provision. There are going to be situations where a one-to-one tuition may need to take place online, but you could put in a mitigating circumstance there by having a moderator who is there to take notes to ensure that a teacher's not putting themselves out and actually putting themselves at risk and becoming vulnerable, but also the pupil feels safe as well. And if we're having a one-to-one session, also potentially talking to a parent or carer, asking them to be present. When we're talking about having online learning, it's about ensuring where is the pupil actually situated within the household themselves. Are they alone in a bedroom, or are they in a downstairs or a living or communal space? So it's about having those considerations. With regards to recording sessions, ideally this really should not take place, because then you get into a whole can of worms as to how it is going to be stored. Are the parents and pupil aware of the recording taking place? Who is going to have access to it? Is it going to be encrypted, etc.? So as a best practice model, really a recording should not take place unless there is a real need and all parties are really absolutely giving full consent to that. So it poses a number of issues. And actually, if we're talking about, obviously you mentioned earlier, Simon, about blended learning, there becomes a logistical issue around safeguarding. Will the school have the capacity to ensure that safeguarding can take place both online and in physical sense? So it's really looking at the capacity issue of the school as well.
Okay. And you've mentioned a couple of times about teachers ensuring that they're safeguarded as well. What other advice have you given schools on this? Because it's probably something that gets overlooked ever so slightly when it comes to these sorts of situations, but what guidance have you been giving to schools?
So we've given schools, as I mentioned previously, a wealth of resources that they can use, one of which being a teacher user agreement code of conduct and a code of conduct for remote learning, including how to stay safe online themselves. And it's really about, and I know I keep waffling on about the training, but it's actually about training the members of staff to stay safe online. Because in a number of circumstances, teachers will be very familiar with teaching face-to-face and in a physical sense, but actually may not have extremely advanced technical skills. I know I personally didn't when we started off with this coronavirus, and I'm sure many other people listening may not have either. It's a learning process, but it's about ensuring that they do understand the safety features for the platform that they're using. There's clear guidance given to staff around storing information, around recording, around how information is shared, and getting that code of conduct changed. Obviously, during this time with the changes to practice, the general staff code of conduct will have to have included a COVID clause somewhere to represent the changes to practice. But we are actually recommending that actually schools implement a specific guidance for teachers teaching online and actually the safeguarding aspects that go alongside that.
Okay, brilliant. When it comes to attendance, obviously it feels a little bit easier to miss a Zoom call, for example. And I know having had meetings conducted in a similar manner, it's much easier to not show up to a digital meeting than it is in person. Are schools treating attendance the same way when it comes to that kind of thing? And what's the sort of safeguarding risk there? If a pupil isn't visible online, is that something that should be treated just as importantly as if they weren't in a lesson, for example?
Yes, I think so. With regards to attendance, obviously the key element here is the child safe if they're not attending, and if they're not attending, where is the child? If we're discussing obviously attendance during coronavirus and remote learning, the same principle should be applied. Actually, the school should have some form of communication with the child on a daily basis. We know in practice this is an extremely difficult task. Some of our member schools that we're working with would actually spend 80% of their time conducting safeguarding welfare calls as opposed to teaching an online learning, because actually safeguarding was the utmost key priority for some of our schools, especially with some more of the disadvantaged families. So with regards to attendance, if a pupil does not attend online, that does need to be followed up. I'll give you a case example of a school that we worked with, one of our schools that we worked with recently, obviously not mentioning names or country location, but we worked with a school with a young pupil who had attended a few online sessions, appeared happy online, absolutely fine, had missed a couple of sessions, but not too many. When this young girl returned to school after the COVID-19 lockdown, the school implemented, they asked the children to draw a picture to explain what had happened during lockdown and had they, you know, explain what they'd been doing. This little girl actually wrote on a piece of paper and drew a picture explaining that on a number of occasions she actually hadn't had any food, the electricity had gone out, and that's why she'd missed her online lessons, and that the heating had been turned off, and there wasn't any hot water. So actually what had happened was she'd missed the sessions because the parents hadn't had the money to continue to pay for the electric bill during that time. So that immediately was a safeguarding concern. And we're seeing far greater disclosures taking place of this type of situation that I've just explained now. So attendance is absolutely key. If somebody's not attending either in person or online, we really do need to follow up the same way that we would in school. Why are they not attending? Are they okay? And actually speaking to the child themselves to ensure that they are actually okay, not just taking a parental or carer word for it.
Of course, yeah. And that, is that part of the planning when it comes to blended learning? Because I presume that a child might not be as likely to disclose when they're online, but perhaps coming into school where they feel safer, they're more likely to do that. So is it trying to get that balance right when it comes to more vulnerable children?
Yes, I think something that the Safeguarding Alliance have identified during COVID-19, and actually I raised this when I spoke to the Education Select Committee in the United Kingdom, is we are seeing an increase of vulnerabilities and an increase of risk to the child. When we're discussing blended learning, it's a child may not feel safe to make a disclosure because they're still within the home themselves. And if they make the disclosure and nothing happens, potentially that child could be at greater risk. So actually, it's really about striking that balance. And this is really when staff need to ensure that their safeguarding training is really up to date on how to identify those children who may be at risk, who may be scared or may not have the opportunity to make a disclosure. If we're talking about children conducting home learning, if they're, for example, in a room with potentially an abuser, they're not going to make that disclosure. So it's about how we then provide those young people the opportunities to disclose. And that really goes back down to our welfare and wellbeing checklists, you know, speaking to the young person, giving them every opportunity to voice any concerns they have. But in reality, I don't think we're going to start seeing an increase of disclosures until pupils are back in school and they've been back in school for some time. And that then brings me on to actually, we need to ensure that our staffing pools are absolutely prepped for the potential of an increase in disclosure when pupils do start coming back into the physical sense into school.
Of course, yeah. You mentioned earlier that you work sort of globally and work with lots of international schools. Are there any sort of specific problems or concerns or anomalies that you find when working in particular regions, and how do you sort of address those, especially for staff, I guess, that perhaps, you know, on the international sector, they may have moved around from one continent to another, and where are the complications there?
So something that we do a lot of, actually, we do a lot of identifying safeguarding trends on a global scale. Something that we're looking at the moment, specifically with the expat communities, is the potential increase in mental health crisis for the very first time for a number of pupils. Obviously, COVID-19 has meant that many families have been unable to travel during this time. And many families are actually feeling very, very isolated. And that then means that their only form of communication is actually the internet, social media, and it's how really we ensure that they remain safe whilst using the internet. We're seeing a sharp rise of younger pupils, 8 years old, 9 years old, using apps such as TikTok and other applications, whereas they may not have prior to COVID-19, because actually that's how they're now communicating and socialising. But what we're seeing is many, many young people not having security settings on applications or on the internet themselves, because they don't know anything about it. And I think it's that feeling of isolation that's causing this. And this then really gives us quite a concern, actually, with regards to online safety. And actually how there's been a huge increase. I know that Europol quoted that national law enforcement agents and authorities of 27 European Union states have reported a rise in paedophile activities during COVID-19 online. This really just shows you that actually many young people are being pushed to the internet, but do they have the skills to stay safe? And what we're seeing is, specifically with an expat and global community, is a sharp rise, increase online, coupled with feeling isolated and feeling a lack of community because they're essentially obviously stuck in their household. This poses an additional risk, and this is something that schools are going to have to really pick up on when pupils start to come back to school.
Yeah, of course, right. And do you think, I know part of your role is preparing schools to kind of get their safeguarding policy in order prior to an Ofsted or an international inspectorate coming to visit them. What do you see this being a big part of the inspectorate going forward? Is that something you'll be helping schools with as the inspections come around again?
Yes, so we're already starting to do that. So we've put together a COVID-19 critical incident management program, which really is supporting schools to not just have a safe return, but ensure a maintained safe return. Something that we do, obviously, from an international perspective, being an international company, is we really look at best guidance models out there. What we found is some countries have got very little guidance and seem to have thrown caution to the wind in terms of a COVID-19 return. But some other countries have got very strong and robust guidance. Some could argue possibly draconian, but actually very, very good in terms of keep having a very strong system that teachers can follow. But what we've done is we've met somewhere in the middle, and we've put together a COVID-19 critical incident management program that actually supports schools in identifying non-COVID-19 crisis that could potentially affect a second closure. What we're finding is, in terms of preparation, it's really important that schools do not become so COVID-centric that they lose sight of the other general safeguarding aspects that we really need to remember. We're already seeing internationally, obviously, Simon, you mentioned inspection processes. We're already seeing, for example, in the United Kingdom, the Health and Safety Executive are undertaking spot checks on schools to ensure that there are safe practices during COVID-19. We're seeing other parts of the world, the Ministry of Education, the health authorities are inspecting schools to identify what safe practices they have in place for COVID-19. So going forward, I think this is going to form part of the inspection process, because it's such a major event, and actually it's not something, however resilient we are as people, it's not something that we're just going to move on from. This is going to form part of our new practice model, and actually it's going to form part of our wider safeguarding remit.
You're obviously a wealth of knowledge. It's been really good to get all your views on this. Thank you so much, really useful.
You're welcome, Simon. Anything else, just give us a shout.
Brilliant. Thanks.
Thank you, Simon.
Chris and Katie, thank you for joining me on the podcast today. It's great to have you involved. Rather than make this a sort of social media bashing exercise, because there are lots and lots of things that, you know, positive things that come out of using social media if it's done responsibly, and especially off the back of, you know, 6 months where students might have felt otherwise quite isolated. Actually, social media and a mobile device can be a great way to keep in touch when you're physically distancing, I guess, Katie, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's right. And it's really interesting if you sort of talk to young people who have experienced lockdown and been separated from their friends in recent months. Lots of them talk about the importance of just that, those messages from their friends checking in to sort of see how they're doing and see if they're okay, especially if they're struggling or struggling with their mental health. And so there's quite a bit of research that's been done on that recently, and also that's come out of the conversations that we've been having with students in our member schools, that social media and messaging devices have really been helpful in sort of enabling them to connect with their friends, to support each other through difficult times, and yeah, just to sort of get a bit of a connection with the world outside of their home. I think the other important role that it's played, particularly since May, is just around the Black Lives Matter movement and social justice topics. Social media, the internet, messaging devices generally have really helped young people to express their feelings about those movements, join sort of groups and protests, etc. And so I think that's been another sort of real positive that we've seen. Absolutely.
And I would add a few things about international school students. They obviously transition between schools because of their parents' work quite often, or even if they don't and they're in international schools, they lose friends through that process. So social media is an absolute vital part of transitioning and moving countries, moving friendship groups. And we see a lot of positive methodology among counsellors to help keep students connected through that world. And nothing's really changed except that locally people are even more socially isolated at the moment, and therefore it's been really important to keep those students connected.
Yeah, of course. And so when schools are looking at the use of social media, where does their sort of how do they ensure that this is done in a responsible way? Because like you say, there are lots and lots of positives, but the sort of news that comes out in the media is obviously often slightly more negative, you know, being exposed to sort of unhelpful images, potentially sort of being groomed even. So how do schools make sure that students are using online platforms responsibly?
Most have an acceptable use policy, behaviour policy, and many have been updating those as we speak. You know, they've been incidents have led to development of policy. The other aspect is that counsellors and teachers are having regular check-ins with individuals and groups, and small groups particularly. They learned early on that the old tutor group with 30 children doesn't work, and they had to put them into small groups to discuss these things. So we're seeing quite a lot of what do you call an advisory tutor group makeup of three or four students with an adult, discussing things that are private, sensitive, in a much more small group way, because it's more effective.
And so what sort of problems can arise from these discussions? What are schools sort of on the lookout for?
Yeah, I think peer-on-peer abuse, and Katie will tell you a little bit more about that in a minute, but it comes from, a lot of it is minor, insensitive verbal abuse, and in written form it seems to have more impact, and it stays and it hurts children more. And they are sometimes learning about the boundaries too, in exactly the same way as they would be in schools, pushing the boundaries, and that's when someone breaks the boundaries. Parents often find it really supportive to have a teacher or a counsellor have much more of a group approach to it, so that learning, it transfers from the individual to more students.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, I mean, there is so much that I could say about this, but in response, so I suppose there are two questions that you asked. The first one around what are the sort of risks that arise with young people engaging in social media, spending a lot more time online unsupervised. And yeah, I think you're right, like the media has covered those extensively, and they include sextortion, online grooming, online sexual harassment between peers, cyberbullying, but they also include, and I think this is particularly relevant since the pandemic, fake news and the impact on young people's mental health and anxiety, listening and reading sort of messages about the spread of the virus that aren't true or unfounded, and or indeed about other issues. And there was some really interesting research done by young people recently that looked into the impact of lockdown and the pandemic on young people's mental health. And one of the themes that came out really strongly was fake news and the impact that that had had on young people's levels of anxiety. And there was one student who had said, you know, that it really scares her and affects her when her parents talk to her about what they read on WhatsApp messages around the virus. And I think that comes back to exactly what Chris was saying. This isn't responsible use of devices and social media isn't a new issue, obviously. It's just been highlighted and exacerbated recently. And so I think schools were already doing a lot in that area to educate their students, but also their parents and their staff, around things like thinking critically about the source of information, how you behave online, how you behave towards others, and also what you do if you witness something that's harmful or inappropriate online, and do you know who you can go to for support? So I think all of those things those efforts have really been sort of ramped up in recent months, and schools have done an excellent job on the whole at having small group discussions, not only with their students, but also with groups of parents and with staff around these sorts of issues. And there are some really fantastic resources out there by a number of different organisations. The resources by ChildNet International, for example, are excellent, and lots of our schools use those and encourage their parents to enter into things like family agreements relating to the use of social media and devices at home. There are lots of interactive videos for parents to use with their students, with their children, to generate sort of discussions. And so I think all of that has been really positive. I think the only other thing I'd say on that is it's been particularly interesting for me in recent months to have discussions both with the young people in our schools, but also with counsellors in our member schools around the world about the sorts of trends that they're seeing with the students that they're supporting in lockdown. And one of the things that really surprised me initially was lots and lots of counsellors were saying to me that actually a lot of their students who had been struggling pre-pandemic with different issues, but lots of them with relationship issues or peer-on-peer harm or bullying, had actually really thrived in lockdown and had been able to sort of take the time to reflect on their lives, on who they want to be as adults, on sort of examining, you know, like their values and all of those sorts of things. And it's actually given them a time for self-reflection, and it's removed a lot of the peer pressure and the harm between students, which was taking place for these individual students pre-pandemic. And I think what's interesting about that is typically researchers and child protection professionals will, when they talk about the online element, they will talk about how dangerous it can be because it's unstoppable and it's permanent for young people. So they will frequently give the example of, you know, bullying in the school playground you can get away from, but bullying online you can't. And you know, it carries through to your home and even to your bedroom, and you can't get away from it. Whereas I think what was coming out of my discussions both with counsellors and with some young people was that there are obviously it's become clear that there are lots of young people who can get away from sort of online harm and can actually sort of do have that ability to shut off their phone if there's stuff that's bothering them and just take a step back. And I think that's been one of the real positives for us as well, just in terms of young people's resilience and some of the sort of good elements that have come out of this period.
Yeah, that's a good another good positive there. You hear of quite a few students who've actually sort of relished the online learning environment, and perhaps due to some perhaps anxieties about being in having their voice heard in big groups. And actually there are ways that all of these tools can be used for lots of positives. I was just going to go back to your point there about fake news and students' anxieties around parents' behaviours when it comes to things like that. So how have you seen your member schools work in regards to parents and that relationship and the responsibility around social media, both in terms of their use and I guess their children's use?
Yeah, so I've seen, and Chris will definitely have, I'm sure, stuff to add to this as well. I've seen some really excellent practices, and I suppose that's another positive out of this situation, which is that the links between parents and schools have, in lots of cases, been strengthened as a result of remote learning, because parents have taken on, you know, part or all of the sort of helping their children to learn, and for very young children they've taken on a lot more of that, and so I think it's been easier in that sense for schools to engage with parents because they're at home with their children, and lots of them are helping them to learn. And so they've been the best practice that I've seen is when schools have really leveraged that to weave in discussions around thinking around fake news and other aspects of online safety into the sort of the day-to-day learning and the curriculum. And as I said before, that some of the ChildNet international resources focus specifically on fake news for schools and what they can, how they can encourage their parents and also their students to think really critically about the information that they're seeing online and really think about the source of that and whether they share it on or not, and how to identify an authentic source and news that's genuine as opposed to fake news, and what's the difference between the two. And there are some really fantastic videos that schools have used, drawing on that organization but also other organizations' resources, and sort of tailored to their own school and their own parent community. So that's one way. And then I think the other way is really what Chris was saying as well around the small group discussions, both with students but also with parents. And so some schools have got groups of parents together by year group, for example, to have some discussions not only about fake news and online safety but also just about their own well-being, the parents' well-being and how they're coping and if the school can do more, you know, to support them and what the issues are. And I think the other way that schools have done that very successfully in recent months is through well-being surveys, which some schools have issued to all of their community members, so staff, students and parents, just trying to get a sense of how they're doing, and that's helped them to identify people who might be struggling or where there might be issues. So I think it's a range of all of those, but I'm sure, Chris, that you've got some more to add to that.
Yeah, I think I can only reiterate it, Katie. Leading practice in international schools would involve well-being surveys on a regular basis, small group check-ins, individual cases where it's known there are pressures, workshops for parents with people with psychologists' background, as well as parent consultations. And what I think the whole initial lockdown proved was just how much support international schools gave international school students. It was phenomenal. Later on, of course, well-being is the big push, because we were completely unused to it. Everybody, the whole world was completely unused to it. Now the worry is much more about continuity of learning, so, and continuity of well-being too, and the longer term effects. So I think the critical thinking around keeping young people progressing is the next real big push needed. And what we're looking for here is the acceptance that we have to be in this uncertain state, and getting the youngsters who thrive in this online working environment, and there are definitely youngsters who come to the fore. My wife is a teacher, and she was surprised by the children who have found difficulty engaging. They were 10, 11 years old. And those who really thrived and took independence by the storm and really, really took possession of their own learning and were almost more independent. So I think that's the next challenge, and that well-being challenge will then, when it will return to being a well-being challenge as parents and students become aware if there are learning deficits. And so learning deficits that arise from this is still an unknown factor.
Just something to add, Chris, because I think you're absolutely right. I've been completely sort of overwhelmed with the support amongst the international educational community for each other, not just for the students, but also for their staff, for their parents, and the resources and the level of support that schools, international schools, have been able to give. And I think one of the there are lots and lots of reasons for that, and we've discussed some of them, but another really important one, I think, is the role of the school counsellor. So in most of the international schools that we work with, they will have at least one, but usually a team of social emotional counsellors and guidance counsellors who play a critical role, you know, in normal times, but the importance of that role has really, really come to the fore in recent months. And so a lot of these small group discussions that have been going on with parents, or indeed with groups of staff or young people, have often been facilitated by the counsellors. And I think the support that they, the individual support that they've been able to continue to provide to students who are struggling, has just been so critical. And I think, yeah, that's just been really fantastic to see as well, because I think they perform such a critical role.
In terms of the struggles, I guess you touched on mental health earlier, and obviously, yeah, the feeling of connectivity that comes from use of social media and devices is clear. But have there been any sort of trends over the last 6 months in sort of mental health concerns that schools should be more aware of and have a look out for?
Yeah, so it's an excellent question. And I think we are all, I'm sure, Chris, that you'll have something to add to this, but we are all still learning about the full impact of the pandemic on young people's mental health. And that is changing over time as this situation is sort of continues. And as it will also sort of slightly depend, obviously, on the country that the school is in and what's going on in terms of restrictions and the spread of the virus. But I think in terms of big themes, so levels of anxiety and stress, I think, are high. I think that for lots of students, we talked about how many young people have thrived, and that's absolutely right. But I think that there are also many young people who have really struggled and their mental health has struggled. And I think those, from research, but also from our conversations, tend to include, for example, students who have a history of mental health needs, students with additional learning needs, potentially students students whose families are experiencing economic hardship. That's been a really big theme for lots of our schools. And that, I think, has been really driving a lot of the mental health issues that they've been seeing.
Working internationally, are you seeing different trends, perhaps in different regions, in terms of what things are coming to the surface, technology-related issues, or are there particular cultures that might be affected more by these sorts of issues?
It's a really interesting question. There are different trends that I've seen, certainly, by sort of geographic region, either dependent on the cultural context or actually also sometimes dependent on the political environment and the political context. And I think just a few that come to mind. So the first one is an ongoing issue, which is not new as a result of the pandemic, but which we work very closely with our schools on, which is the taboo around talking about sexual abuse in some cultures, and talking about sort of peer-on-peer harm and online sexual harassment. And so I think for many schools, it's been, because that has come to the fore and lots of schools are sort of delivering education and training and resources on it, our schools in some regions have really had to sort of think really hard about how they deliver that in a culturally sensitive and appropriate way. And I've seen some really fantastic cases of that actually, and we're going to be publishing an article about it shortly, because it's not the case that there aren't cultures where you can't talk about it at all. It's just a case of how you talk about it with young people and how you frame the conversation. And so some of our schools, I think, have done a really fantastic job at sort of navigating that cultural challenge. I think another one that has come up both with our schools but also with our university members is students from certain regions where mental health is not talked about in the same way as it is in the Western world and not understood in the same way. I think sometimes what can happen is it's confusing for young people, or it can be, when they attend an international school or a university in, for example, the United States or the UK or another sort of country in Western Europe, and they start exploring their mental health in that cultural context. And then as a result of the lockdown, many of those students, I was talking to a school recently that had sort of over 90 nationalities, and a lot of the students had sort of come to terms with some like issues in their past that relate and that had caused them mental health issues. And so then going back to their culture, where it's not as easy to talk about in that way, I think that can sometimes be difficult for young people. And so our schools and our universities have been very alive to that issue and have been supporting those young people who've gone back and might be talking to their families for the first time about mental health issues that they've been experiencing. I think the other sort of big theme related to political environment has been the Black Lives Matter movement, and particularly we've seen a lot of concerns raised by young people in international schools around the world who were hoping to go and study in the US, who are now sort of concerned by what they're seeing and worried about the polarization of society, the sort of racism and discrimination that they're seeing via the media. And I think that has also had an impact on students' mental health. And then I think the final thing is one that Chris will definitely be able to talk to much better than I can, but it's to do with sort of how different governments regulate privacy, like the sharing of information once someone is known to be infected or to have the virus, and some of the implications for schools around that.
Yes, I can give you an example of an African country where a 16-year-old was taken from a school and put into quarantine and ended up being there for something in the order of 6 to 8 weeks. I can't remember exactly what the head of school reported to me. And it was also the parent community reacting badly to the news of someone having COVID. Instead of an empathetic, supportive response, there was a fear and danger response. And we know that when people's lives feel threatened, people can be wonderfully humanitarian, and they can also be wonderfully appallingly behaved. So heads of school are having to manage tensions around their own communities and how communication in social media happens between the parent body as well. And those stresses and strains on school leaders are taking their toll, actually, we think, at the moment. And in some countries, there's regulation about data privacy, as Katie says. In others, that's not well established. International schools tend to follow international standards, and they are, all of them, looking to organisations like ourselves to help them set benchmarks for for data privacy regulations and acceptable use. And when you're having to manage the behaviour of parents as well as the behaviour of students, it's not easy.
No, it's certainly complicated. I guess so. Schools have come a long way in the last 6 months and probably realised that shying away from technology, fake news, these sorts of issues and isn't the way forward. And they're probably sort of a lot of them facing them head on. Or perhaps are you seeing examples, Katie, of schools where they're sort of embracing it a little bit and perhaps even incorporating social media screens and technology in a way that it's part of the curriculum now and it's used constructively to make it sort of, yeah, turn it into a positive, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know that Chris will be able to talk to this as well, probably better than I can. But I think that is definitely another positive that's come out of this situation, which it's just accelerated a trend that was happening anyway, which is sort of leveraging and incorporating developments in technology in the best way possible into the curriculum and in order to advance learning. And also, you know, when weaving online safety resources that are available via the internet and social media into those classes, also for the protection of children. But I think in terms of the way that schools deliver teaching and learning, it's really sort of revolutionized it, and lots of schools are doing some really fantastic things on that front and using sort of platforms and new platforms that they didn't use before and so on. And I know, I mean, Chris, I'm sure you have a lot to add to that.
Yeah, the first thing to say is that CIS accredited schools, the international schools that are part of our organization, have a standard that they have to achieve, which is involving a digital citizenship curriculum, which these days is part of global citizenship and the way you're thinking about behaving between cultures, within cultures, between countries, within countries. That's normal. And what we are seeing is critical thinking around that. So we talked about fake news earlier, but we also talk about media bias and image, and you often see that in international school curricula, even before this scenario. What's happened in recent months is the need to have both proactive and reactive curricula. So some things are done on a regular basis anyway, with age-appropriate units of work that involve students thinking about media messages, how they bias things, how they can distort things. And then they go on to, they would react to situations like, for example, the impression that Facebook gives you, the researched impression that everybody is very happy, except when they're not. But it biases the normal day-to-day life of emotions, because people mostly only post things when they're in a positive light. Yeah. So the other thing I think is co-construction and simulation of the working environment. We had seen things like collaborative tools being used in classrooms, but not extensively. Only by teachers who were used to that methodology. Now we're seeing all teachers using that methodology. And co-construction of in groups of things, design, writing, you name it. And that therein lies the challenge for educators, because assessment is always individual. And one of the things that teachers are questioning at the moment is, if we can do this stuff collaboratively, how do we assess it for individuals? And more balance needs to shift towards individual acknowledgement to group acknowledgement. All of us know that if a team fails in the workplace, it fails, or it succeeds, and it succeeds because it's a team. And that's something that educators are questioning now about, was all these exams that are very focused on individuals, is that all necessary? Is that a debate that we can carry forward out of this crisis? And what would it mean for learning, teaching and assessment?
Yeah, it's an interesting point and I think a nice one to finish on. Thank you both very much for joining me today. It's been really interesting.
You're very welcome. Thank you for this opportunity.
Not at all.
This podcast is produced in association with Educare, part of the TES family. Educare's simple-to-use online learning service for expert knowledge in safeguarding and duty of care will help empower all your staff with the confidence to act when needed.